Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the second of our seven-part series on history, and for coming out on such a cold day. It's not quite crossing the Delaware, but it's cold enough. My name is Jay Barksdale. I'm a librarian upstairs in general reference, and one of my happier duties is to administer the details of the research study rooms, which one of them is the Allen Room. It is a room dedicated to writers under book contract, and it has a long and illustrious history. Housekeeping, please turn off your cell phones. And if you sign up for the email outside for future lectures, please be legible. Every month I can't read a few. Today's speaker, Alexander Rose, historian and author, is brilliant. But don't take my word for it. His first book, Kings in the North, The House of Percy in British History, is a gripping panorama of medieval history, an extraordinary magnum opus, skillfully setting the biography of a family against five centuries of British history. Washington Spies, the story of America's first spy ring, was a National Review Best Books of 2006. It offers new evidence told with style and wit, and indeed is the book on the subject. American Rifle, a biography, is an energetic sweep, at the same time enjoyable and profound, the definite treatise full of lively characters and an abundant spirit of invention. It is impossible not to get caught up in this rich, surprising, and engrossing story. And if any of you sons and daughters of Satan want to read American Rifle on your Kindle, well, that's your business. Mrs. Rose's work has appeared in, among other places, the New York Observer, National Review, CIA Journal Studies and Intelligence, the Washington Post, the New Republic Online, etc. He is a member of the United States Commission on Military History, the Society for Military History, the Royal Historical Society, as well as a fellow of the Royal Society of the Arts. Please welcome Alexander Rose.
Well, this is one of those times that after that introduction, I wish my parents were in the audience. My father would be very proud, but my mother would actually believe all that. Let's kick off immediately. If anyone can't hear me properly, just raise your hand or shout or throw something. Did you know that last year, the budget for the entire U.S. intelligence community, which includes such organizations as CIA, NSA, FBI, DEA, and for those masochistically partial to acronyms, the AFI SRA, which is the Air Force Intelligence Surveillance and Reconnaissance Agency, well, the combined budget was about $50 billion, give or take a couple of hundred million. Now, even these days, that's quite a lot of money, and that's just the stuff we know about. The real figure is significantly higher, of course. By way of comparison, the Congressional Intelligence Budget in 1775 amounted to $0, and even in those days, that wasn't a lot of money. The reason for this unaccustomed thriftiness is that in 1775, there was not a single professional spy or trained intelligence officer in the colonies. There was no intelligence gathering agency whatsoever, for that matter. There weren't even any manuals or guides, let alone instructors, to impart knowledge, tradecraft, or even the most basic of security precautions. Every aspect of intelligence collection, analysis, evaluation, and operations would have to be quite literally invented during the War of Independence. So no one, in short, knew how to spy in 75 because there were no spies. There's certain structural reasons why this is so. First, there's a scarcity of modern major cities where financial, diplomatic, political, or military information could be discreetly gathered and exchanged. Second, the lack of good roads between the scarcity of major cities, which meant that information could not be transmitted easily or quickly. Third, the American postal system was primitive, which meant that intercepting letters containing potentially useful information was impossible. Fourth, the embryonic bureaucracies of the various provinces weren't able to maintain the vast archives of indexed and cross-referenced records that one needs for a fully functioning intelligence apparatus. And fifth, and perhaps most importantly, the colonial suspicion of so-called tyrannical government made it difficult to establish a culture of official secrecy or an acceptable habit of snooping on people. It was different in Europe, as in so many other things. In the 17th century, John Thurlow and Joseph Williamson in England and Jean-Baptiste Colbert in France had created formidable state intelligence systems to combat radicals, such as the Fifth Monarchy Men, the Huguenot Underground, disaffected Cromwellian fanatics, and oddball sects like the Muggletonians, the Ranters, the Diggers, and the Levellers. And let's not forget the Quakers, of course. One reason why so many members of these creeds ended up or lit out for America was that they so disliked being watched by the Secret Service at home. To give you some example of the gaping difference between the old and new worlds, let's take a quick look at Venice's, the Republic of Venice's intelligence apparatus in 1620. At the top of the pile, there was the Council of Ten, and this being Italy, there were, of course, 17 members, which oversaw the Republic's security. A subcommittee of this Council of Ten was called the Inquisitors of State, a body dedicated to protecting state secrets. Answering to the Inquisitors was an office holder who gloried in the title of General of Spies, and his job was to sniff out sedition, conduct interrogations, recruit double agents, and supervise counterintelligence efforts. So as you can gather from the scale of these systems, power of these systems, the Europeans had spying down cold sometime before the first Puritans ever laid eyes on Plymouth Rock. With that in mind, let's take a look at the three basic forms of spying used by the great powers at the time of the War of Independence, before moving on to the evolution of specifically American espionage during the war itself. The first type of spying operated within the upper-class confines of Europe's palaces and chancelleries. The throne dynasts and their diplomats, princes, and generals passed each other scraps of information and gossip that eventually reached the ears of the various rival capitals. Consequently, ambassadors took it for granted that their correspondence would be read. Put it this way, the Habsburg Black Chamber, which was in charge of these interceptions, was so adept at intercepting diplomatic dispatches, opening their contents without breaking the wax seals, cracking the cipher, and making copies before resealing them, it had everybody's embassy bags in and out in under 2 hours. The practice of reading other gentlemen's mail was so ubiquitous that once, when some tired codebreaker forgot to replace the letters back in their envelopes, the British ambassador made the pretense of complaining to Count Kaunitz, the Austrian chancellor, about this disgraceful breach of etiquette. Kaunitz, in his worldly way, didn't bother denying the charge, but urbanely remarked, "Oh, these people are so clumsy." A second form of spying is better described as military reconnaissance. Soldiers would be sent out on missions to probe enemy lines, sketch fortifications, and map the lay of the land. This was the most ancient form of espionage and could claim pedigree harking back to at least Moses, who dispatched 12 Israelites to, as the Bible says, spy out the land of Canaan. Similar accounts can be found in the works of Homer, Thucydides, and Julius Caesar. Following in their footsteps, the rather less imposing figure of General Thomas Gage, officer commanding the British forces in Boston in 1775, asked two volunteers to scout the surrounding terrain in the months before Lexington and Bunker Hill. Theirs was a secret mission that lapsed into comedy when the duo departed Boston, as they reported, disguised like countrymen in brown coats and reddish handkerchiefs around our necks. During their travels, they stayed at the houses of known loyalists, a habit which, combined with their stereotypically yokelish outfits, martial bearing, and posh accents, served only to mark them indelibly as British officers on the down low. Laughs aside, the key point here is that it was always assumed that the two spies would return to the city following their brief mission. What no officer ever did was stay behind enemy lines for lengthy periods masquerading as a friendly civilian. Men of honor, in short, did not creep around pretending to be someone else. They left that sort of thing to the practitioners of the third form of spying. These were regarded as low-born blackguards who insinuated themselves into better society and betrayed their comrades by selling information. Swarming the underworld and infesting the underbelly of Europe as the lice and frogs did Egypt, they served as agents provocateurs and infiltrated, or invented, plots against the government. These operatives were rarely ideologically inclined and sought instead money or preferment. As one clear-eyed Bavarian instruction noted in 1773, without money, one does not get far with these fellows. These fellows, by the way, were sometimes dubbed ambodexters, as they changed sides with enviable ease. Understandably, these men bestowed upon the pursuit of espionage a somewhat unsavory reputation. The playwright Ben Jonson amusingly captured the prevailing image and pathetic fates of these creatures. Spies, you are light and you are sorry. Spies, you are lights in state, but of base stuff, who, when you have burnt yourselves down to the snuff, stink and are thrown away. End, fair enough. That's Ben Jonson for you. At the beginning of the war in America, nevertheless, Washington was bereft of even the ambidextrous, questionable services. His army, too, was very inexperienced when it came to military reconnaissance and the craft of cartography. Neither were there any grand palaces or royal courts to trade gossip in. So almost as soon as he took command of the newly formed Continental Army in the summer of 1775, Washington was determined to improve his intelligence arm. Unlike many of his counterparts, I should add, Washington had long appreciated the critical importance of intelligence to operations and net assessment. He had been initiated into good practice early in his career, before the outbreak of the French and Indian War, when as a young and ambitious officer, he was directed in October 1753 to discover whether the enemy was building forts in British territory. Robert Dinwiddie, Virginia's lieutenant governor, asked him to find out, quote, what forts the French have erected and where, how they are garrisoned and appointed, and what is their distance from each other. And from the best intelligence you can procure, you are to learn what gave occasion to this expedition of the French, how they are like to be supported, and what their pretensions are. Adhering to the gentlemanly dictates of military reconnaissance, Washington remained in uniform as he visited Fort Leboeuf in the Ohio Valley. While the French commander read a letter from Dinwiddie, Washington, as was the customs of the time, was permitted to wander around. He returned home carrying sketches of the fort's defenses. This kind of seasoning, aided by Washington's own proclivities towards caution and skepticism in all things, proved invaluable in inculcating a fierce appreciation of the ways and means of good intelligence gathering. During the Revolution, Washington innately grasped the need to acquire reports from myriad, often contradictory sources, to cross-reference their information to distinguish fact from fiction, and to evaluate their timeliness and utility before acting. He was all too aware that spying was, and is, a game that tends to attract fantasists and adventurers, and that even the best agents tend to exaggerate their findings to impress their managers. To that end, Washington always insisted on strictly sober observations, solid reporting, value for money, and an absence of speculation. Now, we're fortunate in having several instances of the kinds of instructions that Washington sent his agents. The general directed one such operative to focus on, how many naval transports the enemy has, whether they are preparing for the reception of troops and know what number of men are upon Long Island, whether they are moving or stationary, what has become of their draft horses, whether they appear to be collecting them for a move, how they are supplied with provisions, what arrivals, whether with men or provisions, and whether any troops have been embarked within these few days. We can gather from this exhaustive laundry list that Washington's most perceptive insight was that intelligence gathering was not about daring escapades and supervillains and Machiavellian plots, but rather consisted of laboriously assembling a pile of random facts collected by operatives of varying quality in order to form a vague estimate of the enemy's strength, a hazy prediction of his motions, and a fuzzy hypothesis of his designs. Washington, in short, understood that real espionage is a little like trying to guess the subject of a 10,000-piece jigsaw puzzle when you only have a couple of hundred pieces available. And even then, you're not really sure if they're from the same box or they've all gotten mixed up or why inexplicably you have 25 corner pieces. Anyone with kids here will know what I'm talking about. Washington was not, of course, infallible. Especially at the beginning of the war, he made elementary errors. Some of these were quite amusing, such as when he wrote to a top-secret operative that it runs in my head that I was to correspond with you by a fictitious name. If so, I have forgotten the name and must be reminded of it again. Washington could also be quite blasphemous in his efforts to acquire information. In October 1778, two Tories named John Blair and David Farnsworth were caught carrying $10,000, all counterfeited by the British in an effort to devalue the dollar, which Congress was doing very well in that respect anyway. Washington insisted that it was, as he said, necessary to have them executed and requested a sensible clergyman to get as ample a confession from them as possible. To this end, Washington asked the Reverend Alexander McWhirter to minister to the doomed counterfeiters in their cell. "While it serves to prepare them spiritually for the other world," Washington remarked, "it will naturally lead to the intelligence we want." And so it was that before they were shuffled off this mortal coil, Blair and Farnsworth, desperate for divine redemption, blurted out to their trusted confessor the names of their contacts and friends, who soon joined them. This sort of behavior rarely, if ever, makes an appearance in the typical Washington hagiography. To portray a saint with the whiff of sulfur about him would betray everything the good Parson Weems stood for. Indeed, this reluctance to believe the worst of Washington still holds. The WikiLeaks website, which some of you may have heard of, recently claimed that it disgorged all those diplomatic cables because every American schoolchild is taught that George Washington, the country's first president, could not tell a lie. Now, what's striking or touching about this contention, is not the belief that American school children are still taught this, but that for many, Washington remains the supreme paladin of honesty, a man constitutionally unable to traffic in half-truths. In the final portion of this talk, I'll return to this point. But for the moment, let me just shift the focus away from Washington as spymaster and take a look at his system and how it evolved from 1775 onwards. In the first half of that year, and this was before, as I said, Washington had assumed command of the Continental Army, the American militia units camped outside British-held Boston relied on receiving sporadic and generally untrustworthy intelligence from British deserters and prisoners. There was also an active trade in information passed on by merchants and ministers traveling back and forth across the lines. Now, this intelligence was often of higher quality than that acquired from deserters and prisoners, partly because the civilians were better connected socially. It was, for example, a New Hampshire merchant, friendly with some British officers, who left Boston on June 9th and went on to report to his provincial committee of safety that General Gage was planning to soon launch a major strike. The Battle of Bunker Hill would take place little more than a week later. The problem with relying on traders and clerics was that they were not military men, and so rarely knew the difference between, say, a company and a brigade, or the various types of artillery. After Bunker Hill, for that reason, Washington strove to improve American capabilities by using his own soldiers as temporary agents instead of civilians. Rather than waiting for the intelligence to come to him via deserters and merchants, he would send men to get it themselves. The most famous of these soldier spies was the ill-starred Captain Nathan Hale, who was easily caught by Robert Rogers, who was a well-known killing gentleman of the time. For Washington, Hale's hanging in September 1776 capped a string of such failures. Indeed, despite several successful efforts to sneak soldiers across the British lines on Long and Staten Islands, few had managed to bring back anything more than useless observations. For instance, William Treadwell and Benjamin Ludlam bravely voyaged to Long Island, had a sniff about, and returned with the distinctly unhelpful news that a party of the Light Horse seized upon some bread, flour, and salt, which was in a store, but can't tell you the exact place. Now, part of the reason for this lack of results was that these ad hoc spies were untrained and unsupported by any kind of network behind enemy lines. Hence, they were expected only to scout the foe and return to base within a couple of days, as was the tradition in Europe, as I said, and what Gage had done in Boston. Washington's victories at Trenton and Princeton in the winter of 1776 allowed him a respite to reassess his intelligence system. At this point, Washington now decided that he again wanted more civilian involvement. It really wasn't a bad idea, because 18th century warfare was limited in that civilians were generally not counted as combatants. They could easily obtain passes to enter enemy-held cities during the course of their regular business. They didn't stay there long. Most of them were local farmers or traveling merchants, so a few days was the most Washington could expect. On their return, they passed on whatever information they had gleaned to a friendly army contact. Who passed it upstairs. Now, it's important to emphasize that at this stage, Washington was still only tinkering with the existing model of espionage, that is, quick in-and-out missions either by soldiers or civilians. It's during 1777 that a genuine sea change can be detected in Washington's thinking. By March, he was experimenting with sending agents into British territory who were expected to stay in place for at least several weeks while posing as loyalist sympathizers. One of his most effective operatives, John Clark, spent nearly 9 months lurking by himself on Long Island, all the while dispatching news of troop movements, numbers, naval maneuvers, infantry positions, checkpoints, and artillery emplacements. Clark, however, was a one-off. He was a freak. Others were nowhere near as successful. For a time, Washington delegated responsibility for the civilian effort to a now-forgotten figure, named Nathaniel Sackett, who was a creative and dynamic force, but one cursed with terrible luck. Several of his most promising agents simply vanished during their missions. Some of them were probably charlatans from the start. And his Secret Service career ended in fiasco. Now, what this fiasco was, we can never know for certain. For all we have is a comically obtuse clue left by Sackett explaining to Washington that I had gone through all those dangers that awaited me in getting a regular plan laid and was beginning to carry it on with every appearance of success, but the New Jersey man fell in love with his horse, the doctor narrowly escaped with his life, and the whole scheme was frustrated. So it remains one of history's mysteries. Rebounding from this low point, in the following year, 1778, Washington took the final step in his quest to overhaul the intelligence apparatus by creating a permanent network of civilian agents behind enemy lines communicating directly with his own headquarters. They would employ a variety of aliases and were supplied with a reasonably complex cipher as well as an excellent invisible ink, which was actually developed by John Jay's brother, James Jay. This network would eventually be known as the Culper Ring, and it operated with great success in New York and Long Island for the rest of the war. To properly understand the importance of the Culper Ring to Washington, you need to know that New York was the navel of the British Empire in America. Financially, militarily, politically, artistically, logistically, it served as London's London of the New World. Long Island alone, for instance, served as the breadbasket of the Royal Army. And yet until mid-1778, nearly halfway through the war, Washington lacked a dependable source of information in the city. There were times when New York was so dark and silent, intelligence-wise, that he didn't even know the names of the British commanders. That all changed with the advent of the Culper Ring. The Culper Ring, named after the alias of one of the spies in it, is unique, I believe, in the annals of early intelligence. This is because its intimate correspondence with George Washington survives almost intact. From its creation until the very day of its dissolution, there is a record of its activities, travails, and triumphs. Now, how did this miracle happen? Basically, through the magic of big government. Because while the members of the Culper Ring got rid of everything that might hang them if they were caught, Washington kept their letters to him. And for administrative reasons, his aides kept copies of the letters the general sent to the Culpers. These were duly filed away, boxed up, and eventually sent to the Library of Congress. As a result, what we have available to us is the autobiography of George Washington's private spy network. Taken together, these letters comprise a remarkable resource. From them, it emerges that for the good and faithful servants of the Culper Ring, Washington was their confessor, their summoner, their almoner. As father figure, he chided them, praised them, coached them, and set them right when they erred. And when they felt their energy or courage failing them, it was to him they turned to refresh their flagging spirits. I'll just take a minute here to talk about the spies themselves. The only reason I can do this, by the way, is because the length, breadth, and depth of the Culper correspondence allows their characters to fully emerge. In most other intelligence collections, the actors remain nothing but sort of anonymous code names on a page. to kick off, there was Robert Townsend, who was the network's man in New York, and he was a secretive, solitary merchant who suffered from depression and insomnia. Half Quaker and half Anglican, he was torn between pacifism and his desire to serve. Next, we have the cell leader on Long Island, Abraham Woodall, a farmer who was often sick, usually owing to anxiousness and tension caused by his undercover activities and the fear of getting caught. So he seems to have spent most of the war on the edge of a nervous breakdown. There's also Caleb Brewster, the immensely brave if reckless whaleboatman who carried the ring's messages back and forth across the dangerous raider-infested waters of Long Island Sound, more colorfully known at the time as the Devil's Belt. Brewster's terrestrial equivalent was Austin Rowe, the ring's courier, who kept Townsend and Woodall in touch with one another. He was a tavern keeper and was fond of his tipple, which made him late for appointments, much to Townsend's loud annoyance. Townsend could be awfully starchy about other people's vices. The rock of the Culpers was Benjamin Talmadge, a high-minded dragoons officer who had been, coincidentally enough, Nathan Hale's dearest friend at Yale, and they had gotten into lots of jolly japes together. He served as acting together in some very odd plays, including one called The Toy Shop, which was a hit on the London stage back in the 1740s, so it took him about 30 years to get to Yale. Sort of Amdram. He served as the ring's case officer in Connecticut and reported directly to Washington. All of the Culper spies, I should mention, apart from Townsend, who joined a little later, came from the village of Setauket on the north shore of Long Island and had known each other since childhood. That close bonding was key to their success. Answering only to Washington, they were one-man dogs who refused to work with anyone they didn't know. As a result, the British found it impossible to blow the network by riddling it with doubles and informers, which is the usual way of doing these things. So how did this self-contained network function? Robert Townsend would pick up army gossip and news in New York and arrange to meet Austin Rowe at his house or store in the city. Rowe, hopefully not drunk, would pick up Townsend's letter and ride the 55 miles to Setauket. There, Rowe would dead drop the package, usually under a certain tree or in a field, for Woodall to pick up. Sometimes he'd add his own notes on what he'd seen on his travels. Washington would then go home to his farmhouse and compose a lengthy report for Washington containing everything Townsend and Rowe had told him, plus his own observations on naval maneuvers and army strengths. He then signaled Caleb Brewster. Brewster would beach his whaleboat late on a moonless night, get the package, and sail across the Sound to dock in Connecticut, usually in friendly Fairfield or Norwalk. Once there, he would either pass the material to Talmadge, or more often to one of Talmadge's dragoons seconded for this special service. The letters would then be raced through Connecticut north to Washington's headquarters on the Hudson. At the height of their powers, the speed of transmission from New York through the heart of enemy-occupied territory to Setauket and across Long Island Sound and up through Connecticut took about a week, which seems forever in this age of email. I'm actually dating myself now. It's all texting. But it was actually more than enough time to provide Washington with a tip-off that the enemy was preparing to strike. Now, this was a remarkable achievement, considering that when they started, the cobblers knew absolutely nothing about spying, and it took a lot of trial and error to get the system just so. To this end, Washington and Talmadge worked hard to find new ways of outwitting the enemy. Now, some of their ideas were pretty good, and others, not so much. One of Washington's better and simplest ideas was to urge the cobblers to write their letters, as he said, a little in the Tory style. So, within their letters, there'd be proclamations of eventual victory, God save the king, damn the rebels' eyes, and so forth. In case anyone intercepted the letter, they would think it was just a loyalist writing to another. One of the less successful schemes involved an agent buying a ream of white paper, writing his report in invisible ink on a sheet, and then inserting it at a prearranged pace back in the pile. Unfortunately, the first time they tried it, everyone got hopelessly confused about where exactly the piece of paper should go, and Talmadge had to spend an entire evening poring over scores of infuriatingly blank pages in a vain effort to find the sheet with the invisible writing on it. So soon afterwards, they adapted the idea so that agents wrote their reports in the blank leaves of old books. The most attractive aspect of this plan, quite apart from saving Talmadge's sanity, was that it saved money. This was because fresh paper had to be imported from England while books were easily available. Which brings us to the culprit's other idiosyncrasy, apart from their desire for security, and that was thriftiness. Their attitude towards money, or rather being paid for their services, is really quite striking. None of them, not a single one, ever asked money or demanded cash to spy. But they did insist on having their expenses reimbursed to the penny, which led to a rather strange situation, considering how otherwise security-minded the culprits were. And that was that they destroyed everything that it could possibly incriminate them. They did keep expense books to track exactly what they were owed. I discovered Robert Townsend's in the library at the New York, and I hope I'm not betraying the New York Public Library here, in the New York Historical Society Library. And there he neatly and precisely lists various small sums paid out to Woodall and Rowe using their real names. So it was a good thing. It was a good thing I discovered it 200 years later rather than the British. Otherwise, it would have been quite a quick trip to the local scaffold for all of them. The Culper's quaint mixture of Republican virtue combined with Pennywise commercial aptitude tells us a lot about how they themselves wanted to be seen. All wished to be regarded by Washington, their social better, as honorable, honest gentlemen, not as creepy, corrupt, Euro-style spies, which is precisely why Abraham Woodall and the others, all upright, if unmoneyed, members of the Long Island bourgeoisie, would rather have died than accept money from their master. To them, for Washington even have offered it would have been humiliating and shameful, as it would have placed them in the same category as that third class of spies in Europe, the ambidextrous. Now, how Washington forged the Culper Ring into a first-rate network, as well as their adventures and fates, is a tale told elsewhere in a book Jay has already kindly plugged called Washington Spies. So I shan't dwell on the details here. What I'd like to focus on instead in the few remaining minutes that we have is how the whole subject of Washington and espionage has been treated by historians. Now, this shouldn't take long because until recently it wasn't. So I left it till the end. The reluctance to delve into the darker or hidden side of Washington was a residue from the 19th century when such subjects were regarded as disrespectful or unpatriotic. Spying, remember, was not a way to cover oneself in glory, and it also seemed an underhanded method of winning wars, a little like cheating. Secrecy, too, was the antithesis of honest, open government, and as the paragon of Republican virtues, it certainly would not have done for his biographers to portray Washington as someone who loved spying the daylights out of the enemy. Now, even if anyone had been willing to debunk Washington as a teller of lies, then it still would have been tricky to show that any spying at all happened during the Revolution. Washington remained tight-lipped, as did the Culpers. And put it this way, Benjamin Talmadge, the Ring's otherwise chatty case officer, wrote a 68-page personal memoir of the war decades later, but devoted just a single cryptic sentence to his intelligence activities. There just didn't seem to be much material to work with, basically. Now, since then, the practice and perception of espionage has radically changed. Today, spies are professionals paid to do their job at any one of several long-established agencies. These intelligence bureaucracies, or corporations maybe, have training programs, college recruitment drives, an organizational hierarchy, PR departments, colossal budgets, pension schemes, the whole shebang. So let's face it, there's nothing disreputable about spying on people these days. As a consequence of the mainstreaming of espionage, there's recently been a little more focus on revolutionary spying in magazines or books. But not to mince words, it's nearly all junk. These writers invariably succumb to sensationalism and simplify the realities of intelligence work. In their hands, for instance, not only does Washington transform into an omniscient mastermind, but suddenly every spy becomes a lantern-jawed, star-spangled hero who saved the American cause at its darkest moment. I'll give you two quick examples of this. First, there is a seemingly ineradicable belief that Robert Townsend, the Culper man in New York, had a torrid affair with a beautiful, of course, aristocratic, of course, spy known only as Agent 355. The story goes that on one of Townsend's most dangerous missions, she was captured by the dastardly, of course, British and dragged to the notorious prison ship Jersey, interrogated by her malevolent captors who wanted her to betray not only her paramour, but the cause of freedom. She kept stoutly mum and died, faithful and silent to the end. But not before giving birth to Townsend's love child, a boy he would rescue from the foe's clutches and raise as a proper patriot. To this day, Agent 355's identity remains a mystery. Now, this is all desperately romantic, of course, but it's nothing but a sort of mixture of codswallop and hogwash and moonshine. This theory's proponents badly misread the sole letter where the term 355 is used. It was just part of their cipher book. The Culpers happened to use that number as a code for woman. That's all. Second, the letter in question was referring to a most respectable and married neighbor of the rather less debonair Abraham Woodall. It had nothing to do with Townsend. Third, no female prisoners were ever kept aboard the Jersey. And fourth, while a certain Mary Banvard, not so mysterious then, did have a son, the boy arrived after the war while she was working as Townsend's housekeeper, not so aristocratic either. It's also highly questionable whether the boy was Robert Townsend's anyway. His brother, a dissolute buck who died soon afterwards, happened to be rooming with Robert at the time. And his nickname among the ladies of the town was the Flower of the Family. Now, he seems a rather likely a candidate, rather likely a sire than boring old Bob. Robert, for his part, paid for the child's schooling, but the two weren't close. Townsend was a conservative fellow, and his ward later went into Tammany Hall politics, much to the family's horror. Now, granted, my kitchen sink version lacks the curiously or suspiciously Victorian melodrama of the original, but the latter's continuing popularity testifies to the grip this kind of silliness still exerts. Getting on to our second example, a couple of years ago, I became intrigued by the case of John Honeyman. Now, he's the acclaimed spy who first brought Washington details of the Hessians' deployments at Trenton and then fed false information to Colonel Johann Rahl, the German commander, that Washington was in no shape to attack in the winter of 1776. Thanks to the valiant Honeyman, Washington caught Rahl off guard and triumphed at the subsequent Battle of Trenton, which buffed American morale after a terrible year of defeat and convinced the Continental Army to keep fighting. So, quite an important guy. Now, something about this whole story struck me as very fishy. and strangely familiar too. Upon excavating the original sources for an article, I discovered every aspect of it. And the article, by the way, if someone emails me or goes to my website, it's I can give you the link to that, the actual article where this whole story is deconstructed. Every aspect of this story is completely fanciful. Honeyman was certainly no agent, or at least not one of Washington's, and key parts of his story were invented many decades later by an adoring daughter who based his exploits on those described in a minor James Fenimore Cooper novel, a book that I happened to read a few years ago, and I thought, what is it? I have read this before. Now, through repetition and laziness, nevertheless, the Honeyman story has become accepted historical fact. You can check out his entry on the otherwise authoritative Wikipedia, if you don't believe me. Now, how could this be? How could this kind of twaddle be taken seriously? It's because when historians, amateur and professional alike, discuss intelligence work, they somehow lose the critical ability to distinguish between sense and nonsense. I quite understand that these historians are taking their cue from the thriller writer's view of the secret world. I mean, who wouldn't envy their sales, of course? I certainly do. But the real nub of the problem in intelligence writing is that authors make no attempt to examine the relationship between intelligence input and an operational output. Put simply, can you demonstrate a connection between intel arriving on a general's desk and his subsequent decisions on the battlefield? What is the link, if any, in other words, between secrecy and strategy? It's in trying to calculate this ratio between input and output that naturally tends to anchor historians in reality and prompts them to scrub the barnacles off the dodgier spying tales. It's when they don't that they lose their moorings and set sail for Fantasy Island. Now, how does this relate to the Culper Ring? What I'd like to talk about is, did they win the war for Washington? So let's consider. Input-wise, there are at least two times that Washington received intelligence that helped persuade him to alter his military plans. On one occasion, he was warned about a surprise British assault on Rhode Island aimed at destroying the newly landed French forces. If successful, Paris might well have backed out of the new Franco-American alliance. So we can say, therefore, that the operational result was that Washington sent reinforcements and alerted the French to be on their guard. In the end, the British, realizing the jig was up, stayed home. On another occasion, Washington was originally intent on attacking New York, but was dissuaded by intelligence reports of its strong fortifications and rising troop numbers. Without this intelligence, Washington might have attacked the city and come to grief, whereupon he might have been forced out as commander of the army. Operationally, then, the result was that he did nothing, which was certainly better than doing something. By and large, though, the Culper's intelligence served as a useful stream of news and updates that permitted Washington to keep abreast of British activities. In sum, all things being equal, with or without the Culper Ring, he would still have won the war, owing to his Fabian strategy, sound judgment, financial and political exhaustion back in London, and a modicum of luck. Now, okay, that said, what is so interesting about the Culper Ring? I think that it is that they were flawed, ordinary men who made mistakes and did the best they could under difficult circumstances, but who were nevertheless tormented by crossed wires, personal conflicts, and petty jealousies. The Culpers, because they're frail, because they're flawed, because they're fearful, come across, despite the passage of 200-odd years, as recognizable, sympathetic, real people. The heart of the matter, then, is the human factor. So, to conclude, the Culpers were not the supermen of popular imagination, but they were great men nonetheless, as was Washington, who, despite his faults, deserves a plinth in the spy's pantheon. And with that, I think I've entertained or bored you long enough. So if anyone has any questions, please feel free to fire away, as long as they're kind of easy ones. Thank you. I see a hand here.
Susan, yes.
I do want to know about the invisible ink in the 18th century. How did they make invisible ink visible then? After they had finally found the right paper?
The paper doesn't really have much to do with it, to tell you the truth. Generally speaking, I mean, unless you're talking about that exact piece of paper.
I just want to know how invisible ink was made.
There are several ways. The sort of traditional way was that you use some kind of organic liquid. You would use, lemon juice or urine, which the French specialized in. And you would usually expose it over a candle, over heat, and it would come out, you see. Problem is, of course, everyone knows that trick, and so it's not really that good. Well, I was going to say, apart from people who, that's why you're probably not that in that game. But the thing with the invisible ink that the Culpers used was that it was designed or invented by a chemist, James Jay, who was, John Jay's brother. In the book, I try and sort of work out what the ingredients of this invisible ink was, using the sort of the Da Vinci Code type clues that he left behind. And I think I worked it out. It's basically what it is, and Washington thought, the first time it was shown to Washington, by the way, he was absolutely amazed by it. He kept on trying to, by the way, because the important thing was is that it couldn't be exposed through heat, which is the usual way. Washington was trying, there's pictures of Washington trying to hold it over candles and just nothing was coming out. He was absolutely astounded by this stuff. It turns out it's actually what's known as a chemical reagent, or a binary. What you do is you write your letter in one type of chemical, and then you need a different type of chemical swabbed over it to expose, you see. So you have to have both chemicals, or you have to know which chemical was originally used in order to develop it. So James Jay managed to come up with this. I wrote this a few years ago, but basically he used a lot of stuff in a medical kit. Things like, you know, the juice of walnuts and things like that. But it was a really good invisible ink. I mean, really, it was highly advanced. The cipher stuff wasn't as advanced. But the invisible ink was, again, to this day, nobody's quite sure what it is because you can't go into the Library of Congress and ask to do chemical tests on stuff burn the paper. I know what it was. And there's also little clues in his letters and so on to Washington, because Washington assigned several soldiers and to build him basically a laboratory so he could keep on making the stuff. It was very difficult to make, mainly because a lot of the ingredients had to be imported, so they had to get it through blockades and so on. I hope that answers your question. I think you were first. The Culpers basically just finished at the last year of the war, and they went on to become, you know, district judges and merchants and so forth. So they left behind no tail themselves. There was no organization of intelligence after the war, though Washington and others began to think, we need to set up something, because at the time, you know, the British were in Canada. The French were in the south, and there were still Spaniards around. So basically, nobody really thought that this new republic would stand. So everyone was sort of jockeying for in the inevitable. When the inevitable happened, they would basically rush in and take over, what had been the 13 colonies. So basically, the place was completely flooded with spies. I mean, of all different nationalities. I think some of the most famous was, what's his name? I think it was Wilkinson, who was actually head of the American army for a time. And he actually turned out to be a Spanish spy. And he was part of this network to sort of detach the whole of the South to Spain. It's a very interesting story. But basically, it took them a little while to get going again. And they, again, in the 1790s, Washington increased the Secret Service budget to, I think, 12% of the national budget throughout that decade. So they... They resurrected the old networks and systems. But whether you can actually say it's an sort of an intelligence bureaucracy, they didn't really have a concept of CIA type stuff. It's much more sort of amateur and ad hoc. But again, they were doing what they could. I think you had a question, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's actually the respectable married neighbor of Adrian Woodall, Anna Strong. She's technically Agent 355. In the book, I talk about this. You have the major four or five guys in the Culper Ring. They're the major people. Occasionally, they bring in a kind of a sub-agent, you know, someone who would carry out, help them a little bit on a certain mission of some kind. Anna Strong was, Woodall's neighbor. And the context of this was that Woodall was getting very... Woodall was getting very worried about traveling into New York by himself. He just looked a bit suspicious all the time on his wagon. So he basically hired or recruited, if you like, Anna Strong to accompany him, even though she was somewhat older than he was, as to sort of pose as his wife. Her husband actually had been jailed and actually was on the Jersey. He was a judge, a local judge of some kind. So, yeah, I mean, Anna Strong did exist, and there was an agent 355, but not. I don't think she, I don't think she and Woodall were an item. Let's put it that way. That's an interesting story. There's a story that she would signal Caleb Brewster by using on her clothesline. She would put up like a black petticoat or something, and Brewster would know. Would indicate to Brewster waiting offshore that everything was safe for him to land. I looked into this really carefully about the origins of that story, because, I mean, it's a great story, and I'd love it to be true. But to tell you the truth, it's like a lot of this stuff. You can't prove it one way or the other. There's no story going back to that time. There's no written evidence whatsoever. But there's an oral story going back several generations. So possibly. I mean, I mentioned it in the book, but it's I don't actually think so, but there's nothing to disprove it. I'm not quite sure why she would need to do that when Woodall could just light the lamp or something. How would Brewster see her petticoat late at night? That's another thing. I mean, there's other little sort of practical problems with it. So I don't know. But again, it's one of those ambiguous stories. It's kind of interesting about the oral history of it all.
I'd like to follow up on the earlier question, mm-hmm. and also something you referred to in your lecture, which was, although there was a lack of a formal network of spies working for Washington in the sense that the CIA, embassies like those of Benjamin Franklin to Paris during mm-hmm. the war and afterwards, diplomatic posts,
yep.
places like that, were regularly used to glean information about the activities of foreign governments. And also from what I've read about them, and this was confirmed to me by someone who worked for our best-known intelligence agency for many decades, a friend of my father's, the vast majority of them are never the type 3 spies that you refer to.
Mm-hmm.
And where they get most of their information in other countries is by the fact that they're multilingual and can read newspapers in the language as well as government documents, many of which no one else bothers, including the residents of those countries, to read. And this is how they channel the information back.
Yeah. Open source intelligence is useful. I mean, Washington was adamant that he be sent newspapers from New York. That's where they got most of their information from. As for the embassies, I mean, Franklin was taking a cue from what already existed. Franklin was very good at ferreting out information from, especially the French embassy and so on. And he had there's a story that his secretary Edward Bancroft. Bancroft was actually a British agent, and there's a story that Bancroft was actually feeding all of the American news that Franklin received back to London. So, but also at the same time, he was speculating on the stock exchange about knowing when a certain treaty was finished. So there's a lot of that. I mean, the French Franklin and Bancroft in Paris. The intelligence stuff going on there is very interesting. That's part of an old world system. That's what they picked up on. Yeah, I mean, most intelligence work is basically reading newspapers. I mean, that's and listening to the radio. That's what it mostly consists of. Is analysis. Oh, sorry. Okay. Did everyone? Sorry. I hope I haven't been ranting on without anyone knowing what I was talking about. I've just been asked to repeat questions. Sorry. Yes.
Francis so useful and came to be such a reliable person that he kept him on as his basic close aide throughout his presidency, partly in appreciation of his loyalty and his ability. Now, I don't see what you're trying to tell us is that a lot of the things we've heard may not exactly be. So my question is, how much of this is true and how much of it is just something built up?
I'd say the Samuel Francis is, I think he's the guy who ran, he owned the Francis Tavern downtown. The story is that he passed on some information intelligence occasionally. Again, there's nothing to disprove that at all. Whether he was quite as important as we have been led to believe is quite another matter. I mean, these guys tend to have an interest in exaggerating how important they were. The other thing is that you always have to think about the practicalities. How would Samuel Francis have gotten that information to Washington? That's the devil's in the details with this stuff. But again, there's nothing to disprove. I mean, he probably did. I mean, sometimes, like John Honeyman, these guys tend to, twist the tail a little bit after the end of the war, and in order to cover up some of the more dubious activities they were up to, such as collaboration. The other great interesting figure of 18th century New York in that style was James Rivington, who has the honor of being America's first yellow journalist. He set up a great newspaper called the Royal Gazette, which was basically full of scurrilous libel against Washington. And he kept on claiming that the Tsar of Russia was sending 50,000 men, and Washington was going to, and the French were going to convert all the Americans to Catholicism and all this sort of stuff. And Washington had illegitimate children all over the place, and it was all great fun. There's a very famous story that after at the very end of the war, 1783, Washington comes to New York, and of course Rivington is terrified because he realizes that his end is near, and Washington goes to Rivington's printing house, and and allegedly two guards stood outside the door, and Washington goes inside, and one of the guards heard the tinkling of gold coins, and Rivington is left alone. Nothing ever happens to him. So the story was that Rivington had had been working for Washington all along. You see. There's a lot of questionable suppositions here. One of which is that story is actually just told by George Washington's nephew many decades later, and there's no other evidence for this whatsoever. Second, Rivington himself, and there's quite a simple reason why Rivington was left alone, and that is Washington had an interest in a free press. Cracking down on a printer after you've won a war for liberty and so on, and breaking up his machines, printing machines, just sort of looked bad. He probably went to there and he probably scared Rivington a little bit and told him to keep his nose clean, and that was about it. But Rivington lived for a couple more decades without any kinds of problems at all. There's the real world, and then there's kind of the sort of fictional stuff. And a lot of these guys, as I said, to repeat myself, have interests in playing up certain stories. As for Sam Francis, it could be, could not be. It's nice to believe that. I like it. Everyone likes a good story. Yes.
Did Hamilton, as Washington's aide-de-camp, have anything to do with coordinating espionage activities?
In an indirect sense, Hamilton actually opened up a lot of the Copper letters. When the Copper letters reached Washington's headquarters, Hamilton, who was, as you said, his aide-de-camp, would often open them, and they would be given to someone, or Hamilton himself would transcipher them into plain text, because they were written in code. Hamilton knew what was going on. And there's also, during Rhode Island in 1778 or so, if I've got the year right, Washington happens to be away from his headquarters, so it's Hamilton who has to take a decision about whether to alert the French, who, as I said, have been newly landed, that the British are liable to attack them. So Hamilton sends an aide up to the French, and he alerts Washington at the same time what he's done. So yeah, I mean, Hamilton was in on it. He didn't actually run anything himself. He was just, as you said, an aide. It was Washington who took a very personal interest in all of this.
I thought I heard you say that 12% of the budget Washington earmarked for some kind of intelligence
was gathered up in the 1790s. When he was president. What I'm curious about is how was it, if I can use the expression, earmarked? I mean, there was no CIA, there was no intelligence.
It just sort of gets.
Did it go to the Department of State and War, Department of the Navy, or was it Treasury?
Not quite sure. There's all sorts of ways to hide money if you want to. it probably got funneled, and a lot of these payments are just for spies and you know agents and so forth. And you're not talking about huge sums of money. You're not talking about setting up drones or running huge intelligence bureaucracies or anything like that. So, the national budget actually wasn't that big at the time. I think it was about $1 million or something. I may be completely misremembering. It might be 12% of $1 million, or it might be $1 million. Was devoted to this stuff. So yeah, probably got funneled through internally through the Department of War, end of state. Those would be the likeliest. It's a good question. I never actually thought about it.
It was more payments for information, perhaps, and some kind of.
Yeah, or there'd be a name of somebody, or if they really wanted to hide it, they would usually use initials, and there'd be a black book somewhere else of what the real person's name was, or it would be given to a case officer of some kind, and he would. This is what Washington did with the Culpers. The money would be given to Talmadge, who would then distribute it and just keep receipts and invoices about what had happened to it. There was one disaster with the Culpers when Talmadge had a bunch of gold, and he happened to be jumped by a British patrol who took all the gold. And so that caused some panic because the Culpers were running out of money. And Washington offered them dollars, and they said, what are you talking about? We're behind enemy. We can't do anything. This is ridiculous. So he forced them to get some gold and British pounds and so forth. But, yeah, so that's probably how it worked. Yes? Intelligence helps win wars, I guess. It doesn't actually win the wars, and so you can rely too much on intelligence and not enough on force or diplomacy. Well, that's what comes if you just read newspapers and listen to radio.
There's nothing new in them. I read this stuff. I read newspapers and I knew this.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why they're upset.
Well, there's a lot of questions about, what should actually get spent on what and where and by whom. So, you got it precisely. But as I said, the only real war where intelligence really came into its own would be the Second World War, of course, where you have Ultra, and which of course only in the German Enigma machine and so on. Yeah, which means that I think the Ultra was revealed. The fact that the Brits had Ultra. I think it only like 1970 or 1972 or something like that anyway. So basically any book written between 1945 and 1971 about the Second World War, if it doesn't mention Ultra, which of course it doesn't, then it's kind of skewed. I mean, there's a whole aspect to it that's just missing. You have to sort of read everything back in that light, that the British actually knew what was going on already. Well, precisely.
Yeah.
No, you always have to have it around. It's like a bad cold, sort of there. But you just get by. Yes. Hang on. I think you've been waiting. Sorry for some time. No, that one seems to have passed me by. Oh, yes, he always gets dragged in. Yes. The Copa ring, but there's a story that the Copa ring actually busted Benedict Arnold. It's actually not true. Talmadge had quite an important role in arresting him. But that's a different story. But yes, but sorry, I interrupted. Yeah, there's a lot of, again, there's a romantic story about Major André, who was Benedict Arnold's British handler, and there's a story that he used to stay at the Townsend's family house in Oyster Bay, whereupon Townsend's younger sister, who, of course, Major André flirted with, and apparently sent her the America's first Valentine's Day card. I'm not quite sure how true that is. She overheard him talking about Benedict Arnold with other British officers at the Townsend House, and so that's how Benedict Arnold got exposed, and then he did a runner from West Point, and that's how I don't think so, but it's a good story. He's the Jewish spy, right? I don't know much about him. I was going to look into him one day. I think he mostly... Yeah, he was mostly a banker of something. He sort of funded a lot of stuff. What's that? No, you're getting confused with William Herron, which I talk about in the Washington Spies book. Hiram's a very interesting fellow. He's actually a fellow called William Herron. Hiram is a clue about being a Freemason. I think there was Hiram the Great Builder or something like that in Masonic mythology. And Herron was an American sort of local politician in Connecticut. And he played both sides. He was like a triple agent. He sort of played the Americans, he played the British, and but most of all, he played for himself. He told the British that he knew a general who was completely innocent of all this, he could make him defect just after the Benedict Arnold thing. And he was telling the Americans that he knew that there was another Benedict Arnold around, who was, of course, going to be this general, who was, as I said, completely innocent of all of this. He was just sort of this slightly older fellow who was, I think he was kind of retired anyway. But basically, he was taking money from both sides and playing them. This double trick actually came to light in, I think, the 1890s, when some of his papers were auctioned off in a London house. He was a great man, if you admire that sort of thing. The artistry is quite extraordinary. I was quite obsessed by him, so I wrote a whole large section on Hiram, using his own papers and so on. Hey, after the war, he became a congressman, and nobody knew, and he was a very respectable fellow. As spies go, he was a great one. He would also sort of write, he would just make up intelligence, by the way, and just write back and forth, and everyone was playing, he was playing off Washington, he was playing off Benedict, he was playing off everybody. Great American. great patriot. I don't think that they did, no. You misheard. The copper ring did not catch Arnold. No, Talmadge was actually was off duty, basically, and he twigged, he was based in Connecticut, he twigged that that John André was communicating with Arnold, and he sort of went, this is a bit odd, and so he, when André was brought into his headquarters by the three highwaymen, he sort of said, wait a second, who's this guy? Why is this guy out here? And so he's the one who took the order, authorized the arrest of Arnold. Washington wasn't around to be seen. And so it was quite a risky thing. If it hadn't paid out, if Arnold had turned out to be completely innocent, then, it would have been Talmadge who ended up, being decommissioned or, court-martialed or something. I mean, Arnold was the third highest ranking general in the army at the time. So it's not something you just lightly do as arrest, the equivalent of a four-star general. That's about the limit of the their the Culpers themselves didn't have anything to do with it. Yes.
Why are all your spy stories Jersey, where all the battles took place, or Philadelphia, which was occupied for so much of the war, or the South here, or anything?
Well, because I don't want to bore everyone here for 7 or 8 hours. Yeah, there were some. John Clark, who I mentioned in the talk, who was online, he actually was also based outside of Philadelphia for several months. There was a lot going on Staten Island, of all places. There was quite a little spy crew out there. But a lot of the time, these spies only operated for very short periods of time, and then they went silent. The guys on Staten Island, who were known as the Mersereaux, they were quite useful to Washington for several months in 1776, while there was a battle going on, and the Battle of New York and so on. And then they just disappeared. Guys in Philadelphia, they were working for a couple of months, and then they disappeared. The reason I focus on the Culpers is because they served for so long, so continuously, and they stuck together. That's what I wanted to focus on. But of course, there are other spies working, but some of them just aren't that good. You don't know how good their information is, or a lot of the time you don't even know who they are. They're just initials in the Washington papers. But yeah, there were certainly guys in New Jersey. John Honeyman, for instance, is a New Jersey guy, but though he may not have been a spy really. Yes. No, not really. No, I've never come across anything like that. The highest you would go would be a couple of enlisted men deserting. I've never heard of a British officer deserting or, flipping. Again, a lot of the time it's just prisoners and corporals who get annoyed because they haven't been promoted or something like that. And again, the problem with the intelligence that they bring is that they have to prove how important they are. So they always exaggerate their stuff. That's the problem. But yeah, there wasn't any sort of secret sympathizers within the British officers. I mean, the most you can get is you can read letters of British officers, which are always very interesting, where some of them actually are much more sort of pacific minded or moderate minded than others. Though that changes over the course of the war depending on where they are, which theater they're in, how the campaigns are going. They don't go over to the other side, no. I think one last question, or maybe two.
As a historian, modern life and the tools that you have now, is it a good career choice still?
Not if you're in it for the money. keeps the wolves from the door, and it is a lot of fun. You're essentially a private detective. Modern tools as what kind of?
WikiLeaks and the internet. Is it opening up more doors for you?
Yeah, I think so. I can find stuff online now that would normally have taken me months to do beforehand. For instance, the entirety of the Culper correspondence is available online. Through the Library of Congress. It's quite difficult to read because it was, of course, scanned in 15 years ago, so it's kind of absolutely out of date, and it's all in sort of weird black and white and so on. But it's actually interesting that and you have to know where it is because it's so badly filed away that you have to sort of know what you're looking for. But so when I was, when I wrote the book, I was based in New York, so it saved me 3 or 4 months having to be in Washington, D.C., in the archives there. So things like that really save a lot of time. Things like that. Sorry, I think last question, and then I think it's time for everyone to go.
I just wanted to know what was really the initiation of this firing, and what was the final ending, like the final closing, and if they ever were close to being detected, was there ever a moment where they came close to being detected by someone?
Just to answer the first part of the question, I will get onto that. Part A is why did they start operations?
No. What initiated the operation? How did they initiate the operation and say, today we're starting to call for the spy network?
The way it was initiated, or sort of the sequence of events in a way, was that basically Caleb Brewster, who I mentioned as the whale boatman, He was essentially a walk-in. I mean, he was a kind of an adventurous guy. He was stuck in an artillery unit. He was bored. And he actually walked into Washington's tent. I mean, it was a small world. You could do this kind of thing then. And said, look, you know, can I run messages across Long Island Sound? You know, basically, because he liked having a fight. And, he, you know, so he used to deal with a lot. There was a lot of privateers and so on there. He used to just get into big fights with them. And he probably also thought that he could make some money out of it. And then Caleb Brewster, that happened to coincide with the fact that he knew Talmadge, you know, because they'd all grown up together. And Washington happened to be looking to set up a ring or to set up a new system. So Talmadge, you know, talked to Brewster and said, is there anyone else you can think of who you could communicate with? And so Brewster said, okay, Abraham Woodall, remember him? Yeah, and so that, it sort of got bigger. It sort of, they didn't all come in at one time. They all came in, you know, with a couple of weeks or months between each other, and they just kept on recruiting each other as long as the you know, they could keep the communications secret. So that, and Townsend came in a little bit later, but I talk about that in the book about how he came in. And what the second part of the question was about when how it ended. Sometimes ended all of a sudden because Townsend was a bit of a diva. In a way, and sometimes he would just think, you know, I've had enough of this, I'm not getting properly appreciated. And he would just walk off the job for a couple of months and leave the rest of them to deal with it. Other times, you know, Woodall would say it's just getting too hot around here. I mean, after the Benedict Arnold case, when Benedict Arnold was taken in, you know, the British, because Benedict Arnold came to New York and he claimed that he knew the names of various spies in New York. Rather fortunately in that instance, the culprits had always never really communicated with Arnold directly, so he didn't have their names. But they just went silent for a couple of months just until everything blew over. But by the end of the war, you know, look, by the end of the war, Washington didn't really need them much anymore. I mean, after they sort of go much more quiet, much more occasional after about 1782. You know, after Yorktown in 81... You know, the war moves down south anyway. The real activity, and after 1782, it's basically a, you know, fait accompli. You know, Washington's is gonna walk into New York. So there's not that much going in. So you know, they were formally released at the end of the war. And the third and part of the question was, they came close to being detected several times. Pretty close. They were among others. Hiram was sort of trying to work out who they were, and Arnold, of course, the British knew that there were leaks going on. Somehow they couldn't work out quite how it was being done or who was involved. Hiram, and so they sort of set Hiram and Arnold onto it to try and detect where the stuff was coming from. So they came close a few times. But again, the culprits was, and normally under normal circumstances they would have blown that network. But the culprits were quite, as I mentioned in the talk, the culprits were quite fortunate in not letting in Tom, Dick, and Harry into the group. Otherwise, they would have been history within a year. They were also helped by the British guy in charge of counterintelligence was a man called Delancey, you know, who was fairly smart, but he was being played by Hiram. So you don't know quite who knew what at what time. But yeah, no, there were no arrests. So in that sense, they were a very successful operation. So, right. Well, I think. Maybe that. But, all right, thank you.